So this is.
I'm going to turn on the car so we have air conditioning.
That's a very good idea. Yes, it's like 90 here.
Yeah.
This is Russ and Zach from the Emerald City Video Podcast, and we just got out of Transformers: The Last Knight.
God.
It is the fifth installment of the Michael Bay Transformers franchise. This is the last one he's going to direct.
Yep.
And it ostensibly sets up a whole bunch of mythology for the movies that are going to follow.
Yeah. King Arthur's a...
Yeah, King Arthur's in it. Nazis. There's Nazis in this.
Yeah. For some reason, they found that justifiable to literally have that little tiny scene.
It was like, I've heard that there's like 8 pitches going around Hollywood right now that are like different, like, period pieces that the Transformers can appear in. Like, there's an ancient Rome one, there's a World War II one.
Of course.
So it wouldn't surprise me if the World War II scene is like planting the seeds for what a World War II Transformers movie could be.
I guess so.
Which is kind of weird, because even though they're not historical dramas, like, this whole movie just feels like a war movie anyway.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The military is omnipresent. Yeah. There's weird, like...
Well, I mean, it's a Michael Bay film.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he has that...
But there's also the weird, like, military politics, where you have the TRF, which I don't remember if we ever found out what TRF stands
Transformer,
for.
Transformer... I don't know. I would assume,
It's a... And this is one of those things where you get Michael Bay, the... rah-rah, go America, right-wing guy.
Yeah.
Because, like, the global military, you know, like, the planetary defense force that's founded to prevent alien invasions are bad guys.
Yeah.
Because they are bad.
Yeah.
Because, like, the only person who's a part of the TRF who isn't bad is this American soldier who we find out halfway in is embedded with the TRF.
Well, he's what's his name from the previous films?
Josh Duhamel.
Yeah, yeah. He was in the previous ones. Now he has a fantastic haircut.
Yeah.
Like,
I think...
hair is like 6 inches high and shaved around the... It's very
weird. He's trying his very best to not look like Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of the poor man's Josh Brolin.
I thought Josh Brolin was the poor man. Anyway.
Well, you gotta be rich to afford him now. He's the bad guy. He's the bad guy in Avengers 3, and he's Cable in Deadpool 2.
Yeah, true.
So, I want to see who he... Well, no, I was going to say I want to see who he plays in the DC Universe, but it's Jonah Hex.
Yeah.
He was Jonah Hex. But yeah.
He is a man of all things.
He
because
is.
I guess there's only 12 actors in Hollywood, so...
And they're all white.
Yes. But, really? Well...
I mean, this movie was... a thing that existed. I mean, first of all, I will say this. Mm-hmm. In terms of a high concept, it's a neat idea as a standalone story.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that the Transformers have been here operating in secret for centuries and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. Part of the problem is that it doesn't really gel with the existing continuity of having had 5 films where none of this ever came up.
Yeah, yeah, you would think that some sort of conversation would have happened at all.
Well, and the idea that there's like this secret order that is both secret enough so nobody knows about it, and also well known enough that as soon as it's mentioned to the Prime Minister of Britain, he calls off his guard dogs.
Yeah, and also the fact that, like, based on the map, based on all the genealogy charts, thousands of people have known about it.
Yeah.
So it's
Al Gore included is one of them.
I didn't see. Yeah.
They had like a montage of okay, so first of all, this secret order is called the Witwickians.
Yes.
Or Witwickins.
Yep. They had a photo of what's his name? Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
looking
well, because Shia's last name in the movies was Witwicky.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And so it's an interesting, like, I don't know why they would have to, anyway.
Yeah.
They have a photo montage of like hundreds of people who have been part of this order over the years.
Yeah.
And there was Al Gore's like official White House portrait, like the vice president photo was in there. It was like Winston Churchill, and it basically you pick, and they had a lot of weird little things. Like there was a robot in this one that transformed into a pocket watch that apparently killed Hitler.
Yeah.
And Anthony Hopkins now owns this pocket watch and keeps it in like a glass case because apparently it's psychotic.
Yeah. It, But then he opens it up in front of the Prime Minister and threatens everybody with it, and it doesn't do anything. But, you know, logic. It's Michael Bay logic, which is this entire film. It's just, as I was saying as we walked up, it is a series of scenes in a particular order.
Yeah.
That have literally nothing to do with one or the other. I mean, like, so, I mean, if the Transformers existed all throughout time, and, like, it's only been in the last, like, 50 years or so that we have, like, technology that really could take on a Transformer, why did we fight the war? Like, literally,
I really...
like, Bumblebee and a couple of... Oh, by the way, Bumblebee used to be a complete badass, like, soldier.
Yeah.
And, like, I guess he has, like, a really dark past that they alluded to.
I'm sure we'll deal with in his spinoff.
Yeah.
Because the spinoff for Bumblebee is set in the 1980s. He's going to look like Bumblebee did in the cartoon where he was a Volkswagen bug.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why, by the way, in World War II, he was undercover against the Nazis as a Volkswagen.
Yeah, yeah.
He wasn't a bug there, but he was like one of the, but
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I believe he was a Volkswagen, like the limo, I think. It actually looked just like one of the cars that Hitler was always in, because it was a convertible too, which is always weird. But this was by far the most Michael Bay. Like, if you watch the Bayhem, oh my God, what's the? I'm trying to
every
remember.
Every Frame of Painting.
Every Frame of Painting. This by far, and also what's the
Lindsay Ellis has The Whole Plate.
Yeah,
which is, she's doing a series on Michael Bay's aesthetic as like an auteur director, but using the Transformers as the case in point.
This is by far the most Michael Bay film I've ever seen. Like, clearly he tried to outbay himself.
Yeah,
because it's literally just explosions connecting. I mean, just It's also, by far, I mean, he has made some really amazing film. The Rock is amazing.
Yeah.
This is by far, I think, his worst film.
See, I haven't seen the... I haven't seen a Transformers movie since Transformers.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that 2 and 3 are just execrable. Like, totally...
But they're... But they're film... They're still competent film.
Okay,
to me,
this
was not competent filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Like, it hurt my brain in spots trying to connect one scene to another, like match, you know, like over the basics of filmmaking, just he ignored.
Yeah. Like, well, and there were some things too, like we, I can't remember what it was that happened. There were a bunch of scenes where you would cut in to a shot or a scene and it would seem like you're cutting in when it's halfway through.
Yeah.
And in some instances it worked because it was like the Bayhem of the fight.
Yeah.
But like a good example was early in the movie, there was a scene where essentially Mark Wahlberg is in this like abandoned town.
Yeah.
And and like
my God, that's completely true. You literally just mentioned was it Lindsay? I'm sorry, what's her name?
Lindsay Ellis.
Lindsay Ellis has this whole thing where, oh my God, Bumblebee pissed on
John Turturro.
On John Turturro. Yeah. That was a thing that happened. I completely forgot. That scene, I completely forgot that scene happened until you mentioned it.
But there, so, in the beginning, Cade Yeager's character has set up, like, essentially a booby-trapped, abandoned town.
But not really abandoned. Like, literally.
Yeah, there's cars there.
But when you drive in, there's this old black guy sitting on a chair. And which is when they go, I'm like, oh, this is a really bad idea. This is a populated town. Then he's like, oh,
it's abandoned. But then they also go into, like, that church where they're trying to get, like, they're trying to hide from these drones that are looking for them. And they pass just the janitor.
He in a different, I thought he was in the office building.
You're right.
Yeah, which also was like,
there was
clearly
a janitor
abandoned.
There, and then there was another man there, like just sitting on a chair at the end of the hallway.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wait, I thought this was abandoned, but why is there a janitor in an abandoned building?
Yeah.
But so anyway, in the abandoned town scene, there's this town. It's been like Cade has booby trapped it so that if the government and or Decepticons ever come looking for him, he can blow them up.
Yeah, lead them into it and trap them.
And it's not very effective. Like, there's a lot of explosions, but it doesn't actually stop anybody from chasing him. But in any event, when they come there, like, there's a scene where a bunch of government vehicles are essentially descending on the town while Cade is fighting Decepticons in the town.
Yeah.
And Autobots come from outside of the city limits to try and help Cade. Mm-hmm. But the first time we see any of the Autobots is Grimlock, and you've seen this shot in the trailer of Grimlock. There's like an explosion, and he like collapses onto a four-lane highway.
Yeah.
And it looks like it should be in the middle of a big climactic action scene, because you're like, wait, why is this incredibly powerful character just collapsing with flame around him and everything?
Yeah.
But no, that's just his entrance into the scene. Like, he just, like, yeah, apparently from out of nowhere, like, kamikaze dives into the street? I don't know.
Yeah, but that's a pretty standard thing throughout the whole film.
Is, yeah,
that there's just, like, oh, we're over here now? Like,
yeah.
But then there's something else, but it's not like two things happen. It's not like they ever build the sort of like, these things are happening at the same time.
Right.
It's like, nope, we're just in a new scene. Yeah. And no, like, no cut to black. It's just a straight cut to cut,
yeah,
shot, which, like, and it feel, and like the explosions are in half in the middle of an explosion, which, yeah, is actually a little weird for Bay, because he, I mean, the amount of times literally the people leave the scene and he just allows the explosion to last.
Yeah.
Like, those are the only time, it actually, not that I want to suffer through this film again, I actually would like to see if there, because I mean, what, you know, obviously his filmmaking has gone completely off the rails in all these Transformer films with the editing, with,
yeah,
like 2 second cuts, like one, two, like that's all you get.
You know, here's the thing. I think part of that, mm-hmm, is, you know, when Lindsay Ellis and when Every Frame of Painting looked at Bayhem, one of the things, yeah, that they said was that he wants every shot to be dynamic.
Yes.
Like, he, yeah, never ever wants what he thinks is a boring shot.
Yeah.
I think that as the amount of green screen that's necessary increases,
yeah,
Bay probably, like, he can't look at a shot and, yeah, see that it's dynamic.
Yeah.
So he's cutting, because that's the way he knows, okay, this is going to look good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's weird, because I think the only, like, there's one, They're in England, which, by the way, the geography of England in this film, or I would say the British Isle, because, like, Stonehenge is like 25 feet away from,
yeah,
downtown London, which is 25 feet away from the cliffs of, yeah, was it Cliffs of Dover?
The Cliffs of Dover, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they, like, at one point, like, and that's, like,
they're going down in a submarine, because, yeah, never mind, they have flying fucking robots,
yeah,
that they could probably go and,
well, like, here's another
let's
thing,
let's take
by
a
the way.
1942 submarine.
Yeah, there's a 1940 submarine, which I can't tell, I don't think it's supposed to be a Transformer. They actually, no, they,
yeah,
do say that it is a Transformer.
Yeah.
But it never interacts with them in any way. It doesn't have a name. It doesn't defend, yeah, itself when attacked.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty crappy Transformer.
Yeah.
But how... I don't know how long they were supposed to have been in that submarine. Here's one of the things that I had a real problem with.
Yeah.
There's this massive spaceship.
Yeah.
That's like a ship that brought Transformers. And since Transformers are huge, you can pretty much imagine how big it has to be.
Yeah.
But there's this massive spaceship. And it is close enough to the British Isles that they get there in seemingly about half an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, they eat a meal, so maybe it was longer than that, but...
There's, yeah, but, I mean, yeah.
But...
That, which, by the way, they see... That actually was one of the weird, like, there's... You know, in every film, there's, mm-hmm, like, oh, I felt, you know, I just watched The Mummy last night.
Yeah.
Holy shit, what a pet... What a nightmare of 24 hours of... A film. Oh my god. Ah.
And last night when you told me you'd seen that, I was like, well, don't feel bad. I have to see Transformers tomorrow.
But it's like maybe, I don't know, maybe it's 2 weeks or something, mm-hmm, like that. It's not, it's a short time. And the two characters fall madly, deeply, yeah, in love enough that spoilers, that, you know, they sacrifice, basically they end up sacrificing each other, for each other, or for themselves, for each other.
Right, right.
Like, that level in love. And then there's this film, which they have a date night on the sub, but they hate, yeah, each other, and then, like, literally,
well,
like...
And it's one of those things where they were going for, like, the Tracy Hepburn kind of, like, adversarial romance.
Yeah.
But, and before we get into the romance, can we talk about her family?
What the fuck?
It's like, okay, so... There's this 14-year-old girl who is probably the most badass character in the movie.
Yeah.
And she doesn't get as much screen time as you would think based on the ads. Yeah. Largely, I think, because Mark Wahlberg decided this is his last movie, so they wanted to make sure to give his character a send-off.
Yeah.
But Isabel Moner's character has her own, like, subplot, and she has her sidekick, and yeah. they essentially save the world. And somehow, in spite of that character being so cool,
yeah.
this movie still feels like it failed the Bechdel test, because oh my God, yeah. every scene that her Vivian, I can't remember the actress's name, but every scene that Vivian's family is in, it's just a litany of nothing but, like, it's like 1960s sitcom level of, like, when are you going to settle down and find a man kind of, yeah. like, stuff.
Yeah, and a woman who...
This woman who has, like, 3 doctorates,
yeah.
who teaches at Oxford,
yeah,
you know, and it's just like, well, you're never...
Well, by the way, I very sidetracked because this, we should continue down that line,
yeah.
is also, by the way, completely, she's a... has a doctorate basically in English history, I would assume. I forget what the actual...
Yeah,
and philosophy and a couple other things. Yeah. But completely and totally unimpressed with King Arthur's Round Table and King Arthur's sword, which... Shall we talk for a moment about Anthony Hopkins? First off, Anthony Hopkins being in this film. And... swearing, like, randomly,
yeah.
doing hip-hop lyrics, I think it was. Like
between him and his robot sidekick, he had a robot butler.
Yes, which, by the way, is basically, think about from, oh my God, what's the, I'm blanking, Hellboy.
Oh.
He's like a combo of the, yeah, from the sequel, the guy that had the...
Abe Sapien, I can't remember the actor.
But he's a combination of Abe Sapien and, but almost more so... The guy that was just basically a gas inside of
thing. Oh, yeah, I can never
remember. That guy. He's basically a combo of those two characters, yeah. but he's, like, mechanized.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's a lot of stuff in this movie that stole its design aesthetic from Star Wars. Mm-hmm. They have the drones that are chasing Cade for, like, the government drones.
Yeah.
All look like those, like, not TIE fighters, but the double TIE fighter that... Vader was in with the mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. I know what you're
but they bow fighters, I think they're called. Anyway, they look like a Star Wars ship.
Yep.
And then, like, not only like you have this gold butler dude with a British accent and a kind of grumpy attitude. So
yeah.
not only and he has the round thing in his belly, like with yep. the gears and so, like, not only does he kind of sort of look like C-3PO,
yeah.
but there is a scene in the movie yeah. where someone refers to him as a C-3PO ripoff.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, "Oh, okay. That's a thing we're gonna ignite." And then Squeaks, the Isabel Moner's robot sidekick,
yeah,
her little
Vespa thing. Yeah,
yeah, the Vespa thing is like he's like a hybrid of R2 and a Jawa, like because he has the like.
Well, he's the basically yeah he's yeah a hybrid
yeah,
of the
yeah
and
a
ball.
Lot of little BB-8 involved.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in fact, this movie started shooting right after Star Wars came out, and I remember everybody comparing it to BB-8.
Yeah.
But, like, the way that he communicates,
yeah.
it feels like a Jawa. Because it's not yeah. mechanized at all. It sounds organic, but it's, like, yeah. squeaks and grunts and...
Yeah, which and, they understand.
Yeah. Well, at least Isabella Moner
yeah,
understands.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm probably saying her name wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, But yeah, so Anthony Hopkins and the robot...
Which, by the way, I'm super happy that they finally allowed a non-white person to be one of the main characters
yeah.
in any of these films. And excuse me if I'm forgetting somebody from the previous 4, because I only usually see them once
yeah.
and then never see them again. Yeah, so all that the little robot thing, her robot says is, "I Chihuahua."
Yeah.
And... like it's like we had a moment there, and then the first thing they do, "I Chihuahua," and it's like, yeah. "Oh, okay. Well, we kind of lost all the kind
yeah,
of cred that you're gonna get for."
And there was a key point when she needed him to go do something to save her life.
And she yelled, yeah.
"Andale, andale."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what I was gonna say about Anthony Hopkins, Cogsworth? No, not Cogsworth. That's that's from the Jetsons. Cogsman. Cogsman is the name of the butler.
Yeah.
And so Anthony Hopkins and Cogsman. Who is a small Transformer. He's, like, human-sized, human-shaped, and basically has apparently been here for 700 years serving the Witwicken,
yeah,
like,
family, yeah.
cult, and this guy's family in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
And between the two of them, I feel like Michael Bay thought that there was a lot of mileage out, there was a lot of humor mileage to be gained from people with British accents swearing and or saying uncouth things.
Yeah. I mean, that was basically almost the entire... And we also say, first off, most people, if you're going to have Anthony Hopkins in a film, mm-hmm. You write for Anthony Hopkins.
Right.
This was not written for Anthony Hopkins.
Except in the cases where he had to monologue. Because both Anthony Hopkins and Optimus Prime had so many monologues in this. It's like they watched an edit, realized that the plot didn't make any sense, and then just added a bunch of scenes where Optimus and the old British guy, whose name I can't remember, we'll just call him Anthony Hopkins, where Optimus and Anthony Hopkins explain the plot to the audience. Yeah. So that way, all you have is you have a monologue where Anthony Hopkins is explaining something over, Michael Bay B-roll footage of choppers.
By the way, I really love... It's something I've noticed, and I'm pretty sure he does it in almost all his films. Uh-huh. He doesn't... allow something to be on the screen that's words without a voiceover of it.
Yeah.
So literally they pull out a thing and it's full screen. Mm-hmm. You can read it. It's he actually allows it to be there for three or four seconds. But then you clearly have Anthony Hopkins. It doesn't actually even sound like Anthony Hopkins is right next to the camera sort of thing. It's clearly a voiceover.
Yeah.
And, he reads it out loud. And there's no reason, because they're all looking at it in the scene. And that happens more than once.
Yeah.
And then there's that weird opening scene when everybody meets Anthony Hopkins in front of his castle. And he's insane for some reason. He's clearly
sounding senile. And one of his Transformers are both senile. And
but then suddenly after that, it's not like that anymore. He's just acting crazy and speaking gibberish.
Yeah.
Which I'm pretty sure they actually, I think it was a cut back and forth, he very well could have seemed more sane, but it was just such a, they just didn't give the space between sentences, so it sounded like, anyway.
Another weird editing thing I wanted to point out, I made myself a few notes because I have to write about this for work later, but...
thank God I don't.
there was another weird editing thing, as long as we're on that. There's a scene where... And they spend the whole movie getting chased by the U.S. government... this TRF kind of vague evil world government thing and then the British government. And there's a scene where something happens, I can't remember what, they're being chased by MI6 and the TRF.
Yeah. Well, no, it's the British TRF. There's basically, British TRF.
But the TRF is the same, it's a worldwide.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a, because there is a scene where the British TRF are talking with the American TRF and they are like, I'm the head of American operations or something. So clearly it's a global...
They actually say that in the opening of the film, which again... oh my God.
But, what was I saying? There's a scene where... I think it's when they're in the submarine and they get essentially depth charged.
Yeah.
A British submarine fires a warning shot, but because they are...
All those people died.
Yeah.
Everyone in the submarine died. The number of, innocent... people that die in this film.
Yeah.
Innocent police officers.
And that's the weirdest thing, because it's Michael Bay and he's got this worship of the police and the military, except that they die all the time for no reason.
Yeah.
And honestly, and let's be honest, our heroes are killing them left and right.
Yeah.
The heroes are killing,
Bumblebee murders at least a handful of cops. Yeah. And he doesn't have to. He literally could drive around it. I mean, there's so many ways that they could have not killed these people. But there's they take a submarine down. Actually, well, was that the Transformer that fell off? Because when the spaceship that's underwater for some reason and hasn't been found, because I guess, by the way, science is just hilarious in this film.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
And everything. As the gigantic ship or whatever the hell it is comes up from the water, at least one of the submarines is still above it. So it actually, you see it in this massive wide shot, this little tiny submarine fall off and flip.
I think that's supposed to be the Transformer.
It was, okay.
Because I'm pretty sure the military submarine took damage and they all had to go inside of the ship. They all had to go inside of the ship and then they were in their little thing with the arms, their little DSV or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
and they went deeper into and like you find this like essentially compartment with air and everything inside of like this ancient Transformer spaceship.
Yeah.
And instead of like going, okay, let's regroup here and try to figure out how to survive this clusterfuck.
Yeah.
They all get into a DSV and go deeper into it, and then the DSV or and then the Transformer starts attacking them, and it's like, well, that's what happens because you anyway. But this when they depth charged them, and then they're the 1942 Transformer like essentially kind of capsized, and it was weird. But they eventually got to where they were going, but it was not a good journey.
Yeah.
When that happened, there was this random line of dialogue from Mark Wahlberg's character, from Cade, and he goes, "Those are your people." And then it cuts away and goes to someplace completely, and it never comes back to the fact that he was essentially chastising this British woman because the British government had just tried to torpedo them.
Yeah.
And it's like, A, the US government was doing that to you like an hour ago.
Yeah.
And B, like, it felt like it was left there by accident because it felt like they were trying to, they cut away, they weren't going to have this argument now, so they... But the only reason to have done that was, like, if you somehow were stuck with a shot where Wahlberg was talking, and so you didn't want to make that edit look awkward. But when he said that, the camera was on her.
Yeah.
So they could have just cut that sound out. They could easily, like, they could have cut the sound out. They could have cut the shot earlier. It was just this weird editing decision where he goes, "Those are your people," and then it goes away, and nothing ever comes of that. It's like, what?
But that's really like half of the dialogue in this film. I mean, there's usually not a lot of dialogue in a Michael Bay film.
Optimus Prime.
Oh my fucking God. How many times did he say that? I really wish I kept a tally on that one.
I want to get a Peter Cullen ringtone that's just, "I am Optimus Prime."
He finished, it was like finishing every sentence with, "I am Optimus Prime."
And I okay, so one of the things that I've always said is that the movie of Fight Club is much better than the book of Fight Club, in part because Chuck Palahniuk, as a young writer, took a lot of these things that you learn, like, in creative writing classes and just drilled them to death.
Yeah.
And one of the things he did was a lot of repetition, and because they tell you in creative writing classes that repetition helps you to kind of drive a theme home.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's what was going on in this, because, you know, there's no spoiler here because you see it in all the commercials. Optimus Prime is evil for a chunk of this movie. You know, he, at the end of the last movie, he goes off to find his creator so that he can defeat the creator because something. I think the creator was responsible for the bad guys in the last movie. Optimus heads off into space to find his creator so that he can kill them.
Yeah.
And when he finds her, it turns out that in addition to being able to create life, she's also stronger than he is, which is really not that surprising when you consider that she's God.
Yeah.
So she... like, ties him up, beats him up, and makes him evil for a little while.
Yeah.
And when he's evil, they call him Nemesis Prime, which is a character from the anime.
Yeah.
And so there's a, like, first of all, it's kind of hilarious, because he shows up, he's evil, and as he's, like, fighting Bumblebee, he, like, tears a piece off of Bumblebee, and he just announces, "I am Nemesis Prime."
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, that worked so much better in, like, the 80s cartoons, that kind of thing. Like, in a live-action movie, it just seems silly.
Yeah.
But then, after he becomes Optimus again, he announces that he is Optimus Prime a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's two other characters. Sometimes it's in the monologue. You know, it's just talking to the audience.
Optimus Prime. But let's talk about that scene, too.
Oh.
The as I leaned to you and said, "Martha." Because it's basically Martha's scene.
Yeah.
It's the scene where you're
there's
like,
a lot of BPS
why did
in
he
here,
suddenly switch and become a good person? And by the way, Mark Wahlberg is climbing all over Nemesis Prime, who is... like, who decisively doesn't just rip him in half, even though he's an evil person.
Mm-hmm.
He
stops, and again, spoilers, but you're at this point 26 minutes in. he stops fighting because Bumblebee finally gets his voice back, which is a thing. I don't think we've heard his voice in the first four movies.
Not that I know of.
And obviously that's a thing because in the first movie that was a big plot point.
Yeah.
And it's an odd thing because we hear his voice and then he goes back to not having one for like 10 minutes. And then at the very end we hear it again.
Yeah.
I don't think it's voiced by the guy who voiced Bumblebee in the cartoons, which is too bad because Optimus and Megatron are both voiced by their original voice actors.
Oh, right.
You know what? It's not, because I'm pretty sure Bumblebee was Casey Kasem.
Could be, yeah.
That's probably why. Mm. But anyway, so not the filmmaker's fault.
Yep.
In any event, so it was kind of a weird thing, but that is the, you're right, it's like the Martha moment where he's about to kill Bumblebee, and Bumblebee talks to him in his own voice for the first time in 50 years or whatever, and Prime essentially snaps out of it.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, whatever, you know, but, and it kind of sort of works. Certainly, I think if I was more emotionally invested in this franchise, that would have worked more effectively because the idea of hearing Bumblebee's voice for the first time would be a bigger deal.
Mm.
The fact that I'm not emotionally invested in this franchise makes it feel kind of silly.
Yeah.
But if I were really into these, I could see that being a good moment, actually. Yeah. Something that really should have worked for me and didn't. This movie was the one where I feel like Michael Bay realized that Michael Bay was kind of ridiculous and started making fun of himself. And the biggest example of that was when they go deep into the guts of this castle in England, they're like, Anthony Hopkins is sitting there telling this whole elaborate like mythology of the Transformers. And as he's doing so, there's like the typical music that would accompany that kind of thing, like the organ, like the very dramatic, like da 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 da, and then they keep cutting, and then they cut back to like Cogsman the butler playing the dramatic music, Anthony Hopkins is like, "Stop that!"
Yeah.
And so Cogsman was like, "I was setting the mood, sir," and he's like, "No, you were fucking it all up."
Yeah.
And it was like, that should have been funny, and I don't know exactly what it was that didn't work about it, other than just the fact that tonally it was so dissonant with the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and it wasn't repeated. It was repeated twice
in that scene, though.
Oh no, I mean in that scene, no. But I'm saying the kind of the bit, I think the problem is that it. The score was so weird and random in this film. Like, it would be explosions, 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 and then a quiet scene. There's no quiet. I mean, forget, it's a Michael Bay film, so there's absolutely no fucking quiet
allowed. That's actually a really interesting thing, is that, like, because the score was so omnipresent, or at least noise was so omnipresent, you didn't really notice the, like, dramatic music until they call attention to it by telling Cogsman to stop. And then... for the bits of the scene where there was no music, like, because there were moments in between when he would go back to the organ, it would feel kind of weird because it was so quiet and it hadn't been the whole movie.
Yeah.
But that also undersold the joke, because it meant that when Cogsman went back to the organ and started again, it was very obvious that music was starting again.
Yeah.
And once you've broken the fourth wall and done the thing where the music is part of the scene, you can't undo that. And so when they went back, I think two more times, to that same joke, you got diminishing returns every time, because it was like, no, the audience is going to know as soon as the music starts up again that you're going to go back to Cogsman, because that it doesn't make sense otherwise.
Yeah.
But again, that was a part of the whole, like... British accent plus dopey humor equals hilarity.
Yeah.
You know, there was a... there when Anthony Hopkins' character dies... I've got a theory on that. I'll get to in a second. when Anthony Hopkins' character dies...
Yeah.
Cogsman says something along the lines of, you know, in all of the whatever family it is, all of the whatever that I've served for these 700 years, you, sir, were the coolest.
And it was also, like, you have to describe the shot, too, because it's not, like, the close-up, like, you know, in a scene, like, where the guy's dying. First off, I mean, Hopkins is an actor. Like, out of everybody in this entire film, he has an Academy Award.
Yeah.
At least one, I think. He did the worst job of dying I've ever seen in my life. At, like, to the point where I was like, are they trying to make a joke out of him dying? Because he was, like, gasping, but not, like, really. And it was just, like, it was almost like he was phoning it in, but not.
Yeah. I also, it's funny, I saw an article about the brutality of the deaths in these movies. Because the fact that they're giant robots and that they're CGI means that you can do awful, awful things to these characters. And it doesn't really have the same, it's not grotesque.
Yeah.
And, First off, one of the ones that was cited in that article was Starscream's death, where his head exploded, and then his head is a plot point in this movie.
Yeah.
Not a major plot point, but it's a plot point.
Yeah.
So,
which, by the way, if that was a Shakespeare, had to be in the Shakespeare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Literally holding on to his head and talking to it. Alas, poor Yorick.
Yeah, yeah. and so there's that. There's the Megatron and Starscream's head, Hamlet reference, but. Yeah. Which is a thing that I never thought would. But what was I saying? The like incredibly like disturbing deaths that are in this franchise. Yeah. If you pay close attention, Hopkins's death was not one of those. But I really thought it was gonna be, because the way the shot was framed, and part of this is the fact that in the movies, they don't use, like, energy cannons in the way that the cartoon did. As far as I can tell, the Transformers, there is some kind of, like, plasma weapons that are occasionally used, but for the most part, they use projectile weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Hound has a chain gun. And
yeah.
I think Megatron's cannon is, like, some hybrid, because, like, he comes right up to Anthony Hopkins, and basically his barrel is the back of the shot, and Anthony Hopkins' head is in the front of the shot, and then he, like, pulls the trigger.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, did we just evaporate Anthony Hopkins?
He does. There's the wide shot, and there's the explosion, and he does a double backflip and then slides down a hill, which, but it's like he's watching Anthony Hopkins. Obviously, it's not. It's, you know, either a CG or a whatever. But
it was funny.
I actually was like...
But then when he's dying, it looks like he caught buckshot. There's like a bunch of small penetrations.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's maybe shrapnel.
I mean, because he was hiding behind a rock at Stonehenge, and because that's the other thing. This is just, like,
how did he walk up to
them? Pangaea, Stonehenge are parts of plot points in this.
Yeah.
Unicron, the villain from Transformers the movie, is a major plot point in this, and is Earth. So, you know, there's and this is the thing, two concepts that were introduced in Transformers, the movie, the 1988 or 1985.
I don't remember.
The animated version. When did Orson Welles die? Because he passed away halfway through the filming.
Yeah, yeah.
There's two concepts, actually three concepts, that had been introduced in Transformers, the movie, that came into this film. There's Hot Rod, who in this one is not Judd Nelson. Why? Why? But he's not Judd Nelson. He's got to be cheaper than John Turturro.
What? Sorry. I suppose we could touch upon why John Turturro is in Cuba and not really part of this film, but he's like sitting in front of a phone booth. Which, by the way, all those there's like a ton of Transformers in Cuba.
Yeah.
Like, this is, I mean, obviously this is the problem of in any of the singular superhero films.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the fuck is the rest of the Avengers when, like, the world's falling apart? Like, where's Captain America when, you know, or where's, Iron Man when...
Well, first of all, it's kind of funny because they established that the governments of the world have collectively decided that Transformers are not legal.
Except
for Cuba, where they're given safe haven, but nobody goes to Cuba.
Yeah.
There's, like, a Transformer we see there. He's going to play basketball with John Turturro.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple in the background.
Yeah.
But, like... If it was a safe haven, one would think that, like, most of them would just go there instead of living in a dump with Marky Mark.
Yeah.
And
why wouldn't he go?
There was a lot of, by the way, there was a lot of Batman v Superman weirdness in Batman v Superman, like, it almost felt like homages. Like, the stadium where, like, there was a crash site. And it was, like, cordoned off, but everybody could just kind of get in there when they wanted. It felt, like, very much like the Kryptonian
crash. A bunch of 4-year-old kids could just walk in. four or five, like, 12-year-olds just waltz on into the area.
But there's a bunch of little things where I'm just like, yeah, this feels like... It literally feels like they were watching Batman Superman and took some of these ideas and were like, eh, well, let's just use those in our... There's some really weird... I mean, all these voice actors... there's all these actors, like, celebrity... You know, Hound was John Goodman. I can't remember who it was that was Steve Buscemi.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Mike. I'm trailing.
Man, it sure is great to be back to FCTC after such a long time.
Yes, it is, and we've been away so long.
Yeah, but real life... You know what? I just can't do this.
Can't do what?
We have taken more breaks from this show than my wife has had in her entire life. I mean, we can talk about real life getting in the way.
Which it has.
But it's just not fair. So we're not going to joke around, and we're going to simply say that for the moment, we're back, and there's a lot of neat stuff to talk about.
Like season 2 of Lois and Clark.
And the death of Clark Kent.
And the launch of Superman the Man of Tomorrow.
And the return of Lex Luthor.
And the trial of Superman.
And Underworld Unleashed.
The show can still be found at the Superman homepage, as well as at the Fortress of Baileytude.
And we're still part of the Superman Podcast Network.
So From Crisis to Crisis is back.
For now.
And it will still come out on Thursdays.
Most week at www.fortressofbaileytude.com, www.supermanhomepage.com, or www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
All right, so we're back. We're talking about Transformers: The Last Knight some more.
Yeah.
We may or may not have 30 minutes.
37 minutes of my phone might have hooked up into the Bluetooth here. So anyway.
So we were talking about the cast in this is so weird. It's like the fact that so many people want to work with Michael Bay, in spite of the fact that like it doesn't seem like his movies are doing or saying anything.
Why else would Anthony Hopkins? It has to be literally like, I can do whatever the fuck I want. I mean, not that he can't probably do it. I would hope that he has money at this point, but like, it has to be just, you know, $1 million, you know, I mean, but.
Yeah. But so there was so much just, and again, like, I felt like the story of this movie was so much better and made so much more sense than the story of the other Transformers movie I've seen. And
that's really saying something. Well, I mean, there was, I mean, I guess there's an arc. It's like how they got there.
Yeah, and that's exactly
was like, the roadmap to getting there was illogical and not in a, like, it wasn't Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we had multiple storylines going on the same. It was kind of a straight line, but
and let's talk for a minute before we go. Let's talk about Tony Hale. Okay, so Tony Hale's character, this is a, I think he's a NASA scientist. Certainly he's a scientist. And he's first introduced when Cybertron, the Transformers' home planet, is on a collision course with Earth, a la Armageddon.
Yeah.
And
so many things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he is explaining the technical and mathematical and kind of physics elements of this.
Yeah.
And he's being blown off by some, like, dickhead politician in Ilaria.
Basically like a chief of staff.
Yeah. And who's just like, you're boring. Science is boring.
This is ridiculous.
And he's like, well, just tell me if it's a threat. That's all I care about is if it's a threat.
Yeah.
And Tony Hale's like, no, you idiot, because a threat might kill you. This will kill you in 3 days.
Yeah.
And then the next time we see him, he is in, like, the NASA control center. And by this point, we have discovered that, like, Merlin was a real guy and the Knights of the Round Table were allied with the Transformers and the staff that appeared to be magical that Merlin had is actually like a Cybertronian weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to explain all this to the world governments because the good guys are all trying to get after the staff.
Yep.
And Tony Hale's character's like, no, I'm not going to listen to this nonsense. It's magic and hobgoblin. Like, what the hell? The hobgoblins?
Yeah.
But so he says this, and then, like, I've got a better idea. And he gives him this idea, like, okay, you launch a tactical nuke. Because basically Cybertron, if you've ever seen, like, the image of, like, Krypton exploding in the comic books where you just see, like, little chunks of the planet blowing off in all directions, that's basically what Cybertron looks like, but it's in slow motion and it's all held together by wires.
Yeah.
Like, Cybertron makes its way to Earth And the reason that we don't all die immediately, because the two planets don't collide into each other, is because Cybertron is, like, in little bits that are, like, a football field size long, and they all kind of bump into Earth at slow motion.
Yeah.
And so...
do nothing to the atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah.
All those science-y type things, yeah. You know, that actually Armageddon dealt...
dealt with pretty well.
Armageddon and, like, Independence Day, because that's also the other one that's, like, yeah, Independence Day.
There's a lot of Independence Day in this, like, the this. Talking heads montage of the news reports. So when we see Tony Hale again, he's like, I don't believe in this nonsense here. Launch a tactical nuke against one of these series of wires. And then he basically assumes that, like, okay, what'll happen is that it'll pendulum down. It will crash into the bad guy base.
Yeah, yeah.
And that once the bad guy base is, like, separated from Cybertron and is in free fall over the Earth, that the magical weapon that's been planted in the ground in the enemy base will stop having an effect and Earth will stop dying.
Yep.
And everything here works except that the magical weapon does not stop doing its thing and Earth does not stop dying. All it means is that our heroes who were in the enemy base trying to obtain said weapon are now essentially in free fall as well and have to be saved by the Transformers. And then in
that
the end...
That seems long, by the way. Like, they're in free fall. Yeah. They're not in outer space, which...
No. They're high in the atmosphere.
But that scene is... And it's not like, oh, quick cuts, it feels like it takes... No, that seems like 5 minutes?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I thought was actually kind of well done is that Hot Rod has, like, his science-defying weapon in this movie. And Hot Rod's weapon is that he, like, shoots you with his special gun, and there's, like, a bubble, and time slows inside the bubble.
Yeah.
And everything goes in super slow motion.
Yeah.
And, like, he uses it to get away from the bad guys a couple times, and he blah, 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 blah. And then in a key moment when the good guys are falling to their deaths, he shoots them, and time slows around them to a crawl, and the good guys are able to swoop in and save them, which was a cool, like, it was actually set up. I thought that was neat.
Yeah.
But you're right. Other than, like, that moment within the 5 minutes, like, that 5 minutes didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. No.
So Tony Hale, like, you see him at the end, and it's like, he's been trying to save the world this whole time. And he was frustrated because, like, you know, science, magic, whatever. First of all, his, like, indignation didn't make a lot of sense, but whatever.
Especially, then, I mean, we live in a world, like, the continual times where they basically, like, the chief of staff or whatever guy in the room, like, you don't really believe this NASA guy, even though you do live in a world where alien robots of massive size exist.
Yeah.
Like, everyone knows this. It's common knowledge, and it's omnipresent in the world because you have this special task force and this whole thing. But no one, for some reason, believes that, oh, okay, so maybe it's not magic, but it's a thing that happens, okay? Like, it's actually specifically not magic.
Yeah.
Because it's a DNA thing. I mean, obviously, science. Yeah.
And then we see him at the end, and everybody's celebrating that the world has been saved. And he's, like, sitting at the table with his head in his hands. Like, he's sad that his way of saving the world didn't work.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait, were we supposed to think he's evil? Because when we're introduced to him, he's a very sympathetic character.
I think what that shot was the Apollo 13 shot. It was an homage to the Apollo 13, Sirius... He's sitting there and everybody else is celebrating.
Yeah.
And they do that, like, literally Family Guy made a joke about that scene.
I didn't read it that way. That makes sense.
But that's one of the problems with Michael Bay completely is that he clearly watches other films and copies them.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't seem to get the reason or the surrounding bit.
Exactly. If that's an homage, then what it lost was the emotional integrity that made the other one make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, just having that same composition doesn't make
sense. Because, literally the last moment you saw him, he was, like, screaming, going, oh, those people are idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. And then you cut to the next... He wasn't the guy that was fighting for it all the time. Mm-hmm. You literally killed it with that last scene.
Yeah.
Which the thing worked, which, by the way, was super weird. They must have, like, ran out of planes and bombs because they only sent, like, 4 planes to take this thing on.
Yeah.
When it wasn't, like, Independence Day when they shot missiles at it and it didn't blow up. Everything fucking blew up, and it fucking worked great.
Really,
you're like, oh my god, we have enough weapons to blow this thing up and take them out. Like,
Yeah, there aren't really weapon. There aren't really force fields in the world of Transformers, yeah. So everybody gets hit when they get shot. I mean, the one thing I was gonna like, my first thought was like, yeah, just fucking atomize it, drop a bunch of nukes on this thing. And the only problem there, of course, becomes that if you were paying attention to real science, that then Cybertron drops like a stone onto Stonehenge and levels all of Europe.
Which also, by the way, weird. I think we only have like a couple more seconds, but also super weird that it's been four movies on or now, and they haven't invented new weapons to take on Transformers. They're still bullets.
Yeah.
But Marky Mark has. That's true. Has special because he's an inventor. Who, by the way, can't name anything that he created, even though he's like, well, I created a gun that you can shoot a Transformer in the head and the head explodes.
Yeah, like, and it's like a joke because, like, she, like, and it's the overeducated Ivy Tower princess is what he calls the woman.
Yeah.
She's British Megan Fox. Like, she looks just like Megan Fox. And
It actually took me a moment.
Yeah. There's the scene where she essentially challenges him, like, well, what do you have to offer?
Yeah.
And his answer is, like, I'm an inventor. And then, oh, it's still recording.
Cool.
And then he can't name anything that he's invented.
Yeah.
It's... And unfortunately, if we don't figure out what happened to the audio, you won't see the other half an hour of this conversation.
We can, if not, we can jump on Google Hangout.
Yeah, exactly, we can try to rebuild it.
It weirdly takes a long time to try to explain the non-logic of this film.
Yeah. I will say, if you like the Transformers movie, and if you're emotionally invested in the Transformers movies, you probably will really enjoy this one.
Oh, yeah, it's super Transformers and super Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Like,
I will say, this goes without saying at this point, probably because of the nature of those movies, but if you are a fan of the Transformers property from, like, animated series and cartoons and comic books and all that... don't expect... Like, there are familiar concepts introduced in this Transformers movie that have almost nothing to do with the concepts that they represent in other media.
Yeah.
And the thing that we were talking about is that this movie is very much the movie where any pretense of Transformers as science fiction goes out the window in favor of Transformers as fantasy.
Yeah.
The science is not explained and makes no sense.
Yeah.
The ties to, like, King Arthur and magic and all that are there. And then, like, you have these other elements that get introduced to you. Like, you're building a mythology for Cybertron and for all these things that is at odds with the existing histories of, or mythologies of Cybertron and these other things from other media that already exist. So... if you're a big fan of these Transformers movies, I think you're going to love this one. If you are not a big fan of these Transformers movies, it's probably not worth your time.
Oh,
and
God.
If you are a fan of Transformers from other media, you're probably going to be really annoyed because, like, some of the better... like, one of the best ideas in Transformers dumb is Unicron. Transformers the movie was a ton of fun. And and the fact that they have given him a very, very different... identity and presence and everything else. I think it won't fly with a lot, and especially because people like see the ads and they see this technology that looks like Unicron technology, and they're like, "Oh my God, it's gonna happen!" And when you actually find out what the deal is with Unicron, I think most people are gonna be like, "Oh, well, that's dumb." So,
which, by the way, I feel like Tony Hale's character. Is actually kind of the audience to an extent. Like, because there's a scene where he's screaming, physics! And, like, trying to, like, get everyone else in the film to believe him about science. And clearly there's a little bit of an emotional thing there that Michael Bay's clearly dealing with the fact that he, I think, knows that it's complete insanity.
Yeah. And again, like, we talked about this in the first part, but, like, this feels like the movie where Michael Bay was just like, okay, I'm going to make fun of Michael Bay.
It is 100% Bayhem. You, like, just every shot that, every single cut, every single thing in this film is basically someone parroting Michael Bay. Like, if all I watched in my entire life was Michael Bay films, and then somebody gave me, like, $175 million to make a picture, this would be this one. Like, if I knew nothing else, no literature, no references, had someone...
Except Shakespeare, apparently.
Well, no, well, also King Arthur, like, but only King Arthur in the way that, like, somebody explained to me...
If you had a pop-up book.
Through a couple tweets, yeah. Which, by the way, that's, I guess...
That's a plot point.
That's a weird plot point, considering she had a horrible father who was a...
Yeah!
King Arthur basically obsessed, insane person. Basically, it was very Indiana Jones dad.
Yeah, I was going to say, I will give him the fact that it basically feels like Henry Jones.
Yeah.
Like, And to an extent, it feels like Henry Spencer from Psych, where in the first season you meet Sean, and he's like, my father was terrible, and he never paid attention to me, and blah, 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 blah. And then later on, as you actually, like, look back at the flashbacks over the life of that series, it was like, actually, Henry wasn't so bad for the most part. Like, he was kind of a jerk, but, like, not a terrible father.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels the same way here. It's like, we're told immediately, like, her father has apparently just died because his belongings are...
Still
there, but the mother is asking whether she wants any of his stuff or whether it should all go off to the university.
Yeah.
And he apparently has just died, and yet, like, his daughter is speaking ill of him. His wife has all these friends over, and while his wife is respectful of his memory, she's clearly not in mourning, and all of her friends are just fucking awful.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't care what the relationship is, if your dad just died and your mom's friends are, like, coming over for tea and talking shit about him, like, what?
And they're clearly just having, like, and then she comes over and all they do is talk about when are you getting a boyfriend? Are you bringing over?
Yeah.
And then they finally bring over Mark Wahlberg, which that scene was completely incredulous. They go, they're trying to search for this, a clue to find this other thing. Yeah. They both go up into her father's office and start destroying it. Not looking like, you know, you might, something falls over or whatever, it might be in something.
You know what it reminded me of? It reminds me of, and I can't remember exactly what the context was, but there was a scene from Wet Hot American Summer where they were, like, looking for something, and they just, like, tear into the room, and it's just everybody, like, just screaming incoherently, and it's like, ah!
Yeah, which is making fun of those scenes.
Yeah.
But this was like that. That they literally, like, Mark Wahlberg walks into a room, first thing he does is pick up a Etruscan horse or something, I forget what it was, and throws it on the ground.
He's like, crazy old scientists always hide stuff inside of these and smashes it.
Which is hilarious because that actually was one of the big bits in The Mummy last night I watched. So literally, like, somehow it was just hidden, one of the jewel or something was hidden there.
Well, and that's the other thing I liked was where she's just like, oh, look behind the picture frames, and he's like, no, just kick it. And he, like, takes down this, like, painting that's clearly just a canvas painting, and he kicks his foot through it, and it's like, you just kicked through canvas.
Which, by the way, they're looking for a very large object.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not looking actually for a clue. I forgot. They're not actually looking for a clue. They're actually looking for the physical object.
Yeah, for the staff.
And they're kicking in paintings, and they're destroying very small objects.
Yeah, yeah.
Like... Oh, and then they just randomly... There's a cubbyhole behind an antique, armoire. And there's like, no, let's not move it. Let's just throw it.
Yeah.
Like, literally both of them basically pick it up and throw it half across the room. Oh, and by the way, all the women are downstairs.
Just assuming that these are sex noises.
That they're destroying each other, basically. Yeah. Like...
It's like, you know what? If these are my sex noises, then somebody call the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Like...
Yeah, this is...
That's not a healthy relationship.
But what I love too is that it was completely, within the film, it was like, yeah, that's logical.
Yeah,
that,
exactly.
This scene existed in this world of Michael Bay that during this film. Like,
yeah,
that,
the whole movie is so far over the top that level of absurdity is actually, it's fine.
And what I loved... Everybody in our theater, there's only a handful of people, but there was, like, a guy behind him laughing his fucking ass off.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was the purest comedy and, like, loving
fucking
it.
Fucking Buster Keaton.
And I was just, and like, to me, I was just like, oh, there's a handful of scenes in this film that had a, like, a little bit of a laugh. But I don't know if there's that. There's maybe there's one or two I'll give that it was an actual hearty laugh.
I will give him the thing that we talked about before, yeah. That, like, clearly Michael Bay thinks that, like, the prim and proper English accent used for, like, vulgarity or for something incredibly dumb, like, is hilarious.
Yeah.
There are a couple of, like, Anthony Hopkins lines in particular where he delivers something totally absurd with such gravitas and such a self-satisfied look on his face that you're just really like, okay, that was funny.
Yeah.
You know, where you, so that, and again, like, it's just like the thing with the music with Cogsman and the organ, like it works like the first time and then it wears its welcome out and it keeps going.
Yeah.
But there were some moments. There were definitely some moments.
But this film was 100% written. It was like as if it was written by artificial intelligence.
Trying to design a Michael Bay movie.
Design a Michael Bay film that was specifically made for the most stereotypical lowbrow middle America. Like, there was no piss jokes, but there was a lot of, like, you know, sex jokes. Like, all these things across the board. The fact that this film will probably open with $75 million,
it's a mixed bag.
It did it already? I actually use it.
No,
open.
It opens. Today's the first day. That's why I was supposed to see it last
night. Oh, okay.
Night, last night at the 10 o'clock screen or whatever. it's a mixed bag because, of course, it's going to open at $75, $80 million. Yeah. But it's also going to open at $50 million less than the previous installment. And it's projected to be the lowest Transformers opening of the franchise.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious to see. You know, they have a bunch of stuff planned. They've got a Bumblebee spinoff planned. They have a bunch of sequels, including the ones that are set in, like, ancient times and Nazi Germany and things. And it'll be interesting to see if this movie underperforms relative to the other movies. Mm-hmm. Will that harm the franchise, or will it just be, well, Michael Bay's moving on now anyway, so we get at least two more movies to get the thing back on track because, like, we can blame Michael Bay for underperforming and then just hand it off to the next person.
I mean, also, I mean, I assume that they also look at it in a larger picture of this film has grossed, what, probably
the franchise grossed $4.5 billion.
So, you know, that they can have one or two underperformers that, you know, to build a. Because this also,
the other thing is, it's not going to be a bomb.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, the other thing too is that this clearly, this entire film was very much. It was very much a Batman versus Superman, humorously, where it was like, nope, this is building a new world that is going to continue, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you feel about it. But this is one film that I had to keep saying to myself, just because you hate it doesn't mean it's terror, doesn't mean it's not, it shouldn't exist.
Right, yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I actually went in expecting it to be so much worse. Again, I haven't seen a Transformers movie since the first one. I loved the Transformers growing up, and so when I watched the first one, I was like, it's not really my Transformers. It's fine, but whatever.
Yeah.
And then in the intervening years, I haven't watched any of the sequels, and everything I've heard about them is that they're just fucking atrocious.
Yeah.
And so, like, I expected truly unwatchable. And so, like, going in with that bar, I was like, this was not an enjoyable film-going experience in any way, shape, or form, but it wasn't painful.
See, for me, it actually reached that peak of so bad that it was actually started being good, but it's one of those, like, it bothers me because I know that Michael Bay can make competent film. It's like, it's clearly, to me, this is very much the Scorsese and Spielberg problem of... Yeah. He's made so much money that basically I would assume that basically all the places are just like, here's what your budget is. Have at it.
Yeah.
We're not going to even be on set and look at it. No one from, I guess, Hasbro?
Paramount.
At looked over it or whatever and just didn't care. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, that's what happened. To me, that's what happened with Scorsese and whatever. Is it's like, clearly they're just like, okay, you know, you're going to make this much money and then that's all that matters. So
I have a Cars 3 movie poster sitting in my mailbox.
Nice.
Sorry.
No worries.
But that's
literally. It's just...
And there is a weird kind of different bar for filmmakers who have got so much success that now they can make the movie they want to make with no interference. Because it's like, okay, well, you're succeeding or failing literally on your own merits. Yeah. There's nobody who is, like, there's nobody coming in and telling you this isn't Star Wars enough and then firing you with 3 weeks left to go on the shoot.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't to me, I mean, this is like one of the benefits, like somewhere ago, like sometimes the studio system and the multiple people you have that can possibly tell you no or yes is a good thing. Like personally, that scares me. as a person who's starting to like work on his own documentary film. I'm actually bringing people on that, giving them this, that you can tell me no on these things, because I'm terrified of the idea that, you know, it's just my thoughts and the, like, I think that, like, Bay definitely needs that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he can make The Rock, which is one of the best action films of all time. And, you know, it was decently written. I mean, that's the other problem, too, is whoever the fucking writer was on this.
Akiva Goldsman. Who is? Yeah, like, look at his resume. Sometimes he
makes complete
sense. And he's almost always in a writer's room with a bunch of people, but he'll be the head writer. He wrote.
Oh yeah, this was definitely. I should correct
Spider-Man 3.
The writers, because there's no way that one person wrote this. Because
Akiva Goldsman.
There's no.
It's if you looked at it, there's a screenplay credit, and it's like Akiva Goldsman and then four names that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Goldsman is one of these dudes. He did Spider-Man 3. He did. Probably Jonah Hex.
Yeah.
He did a rewrite on The Avengers. I don't think he got the head screenwriting credit because obviously that was a Whedon thing. But he's one of these, like, and he is a guy who constantly gets called into writers' rooms to like be a fixer.
Remember back in the day when was it Crimson Tide or was it Hunt for Red October? I'm trying to remember where like you had like the fixers were like people like John Sayles.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, oh, we need to Spartan this film up and bring it in.
Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, Tarantino. Yeah, I mean, like, Tarantino, he's done that on film, you know, and things like that. It's like,
Michael Chabon does it.
Yeah. No, I mean, so you have smart people, and it seems like
actually does it for Hasbro now, because...
It's hilarious.
Why not?
okay, definitely. But the dialogue in this film seems like, and even for the characters, it's like, they're like, okay, so this is what the scene is. Everybody pitch your best like paragraph, and we're gonna just take the best one, and it's like written by clearly more than five people, but like, and they just piece that together because you have Anthony Hopkins' character who's senile and insane 1 second, and then a brilliant, well-spoken guy another second, and then he's in the car with a robot and he's singing along with hip hop and swearing and flipping. Do you notice he flipped off people? It's like.
And he called Hot Rod a bitchin' ride.
Yeah.
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 That was a thing. Hot Rod, who's French in this movie, for some reason.
Yeah.
I will say he...
has a French accent. He's not French, remember?
That's right.
Actually, he's like, I hate the accent.
Yeah.
But I'm like, okay.
The other thing is, I will say, kind of a weird visual cue that I think was intentional, and if not, whatever. In Transformers the movie, when he was introduced, Hot Rod had... like he had the triple exhaust things under his car, and when he transformed, those turned into guns that were on his wrists. They looked like Wolverine's claws, basically. And his weapon, his like magic time stop weapon thing. Yeah. When he holds it up and the barrels glow, there were six little points of light, and I think that's supposed to be a nod to the triple things that he had on his on each arm and the.
You know, and then there's you know, everything we've talked about two times now for a half hour. hopefully the first half
there actually wasn't that much
hour.
Repetition. So if we...
All of this could have just been... Oh, okay. So it's around... It's six. So it's a round number. Like, the thing, like, Michael Bay... Like, you know, we were talking about... I don't know if it was on camera or not. You'd be like, it'd be interesting to actually have a film like this in a really serious...
Yeah.
Film class to dissect it, you know, like an NYU film, like, you know, really analyze it and discuss it, because to me this film speaks so much. It's you know, it's obviously Michael Bay is you know, up there with you know, God, I'm trying to think of the other guy that does Battleship.
Bruckheimer
I guess Bruckheimer is probably the closest thing as
well.
The Scotts, yeah.
Tony Scott.
The
his
lesser
brother, one. Who's more famous, who
for some
did
reason.
Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but...
Alien? Ridley Scott.
Yes. Who actually can do really good work. But, like Bruckheimer, I mean, fucking hell.
Yeah.
But it's so American, and it represents like everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's like this. It could literally mean nothing at all,
yeah.
Or it could mean lots of things, and I don't. But I actually lean towards
probably not.
I don't think anything. You know, there's a thing that's like there's nothing on film that mm-hmm. if you have like auteur directors, you know, who like there's nothing in a frame that isn't there on purpose. Mm-hmm. Like they're direct, and then this is like I don't.
I think this and that's true technically with Bay. That yeah. There's nothing in the frame that isn't there on purpose, but his purpose is basically.
The problem is that probably not, because literally probably everything is green screen. So like someone made the decision somewhere along the way to make sure that it's not like, oh, just driving down, you're driving down a street in Detroit and oh, there's a sign on the wall and that just happened to maybe be there. Yeah. Like, oh, there's the fact that there's a McDonald's on that corner may mean something, you know, he's speaking to this or whatever. No, because he put it CG there.
Which, All right.
Yes.
So if we magically somehow fix the audio on the other half of this, then there will be another half. Otherwise, we may try to get together, watch this, and then think, what didn't we talk about that was actually worth talking about?
Yeah.
So, but I'm Russ Burlingame for the Emerald City Video Podcast.
I'm Zach Roberts.
and we're introducing ourselves now in case we don't get the other one fixed.
Yeah. So,
thanks for listening.